The speaker for this talk introducing this session is Colleen Bolger. Colleen's also a long-term member of Social Alternative here in Melbourne. She's a candidate in the upcoming state elections on the Victorian Socialist ticket, which some of you may have heard about in the previous session. She's been involved in all kinds of activism and socialist organising here in Melbourne. So she'll introduce the talk. We'll have discussion afterwards. So welcome, Colleen.
So as Daniel said, the task for me today is to address the question, how do ideas change, or more specifically, how do workers become revolutionary, which naturally enough, for anybody who is considering the prospects of revolutionary social change, you look around, you see that pretty much the people around you, and indeed probably in most parts of the world right now, seem to be going about their business largely accepting things as they the way things are as they stand. And either you're in a terrible sequel of The Truman Show and we're all actors, or more likely, things are going to have to shift pretty fundamentally to put revolution on the agenda. The second reason this is a big concern and very valid concern for left-wing people is with the resurgence of right-wing ideas, far-right ideas. You know, things that seem to be absolutely baseless, like climate change is either a figment of the imagination, or if you're Tony Abbott and has finally acknowledged it, that it has nothing to do with human intervention, or rotten ideas that were discredited decades ago, like the newfound pseudoscience around biological racism. All of this is pretty worrying for people who are concerned with trying to win people to a left-wing, and we would say correct, view of how society really works. But I'd argue that as offensive as those ideas are, it's the more widely accepted insidious assumptions that are more central to propping up the system. Things like the police are here to protect us, or even the bosses have a right to determine what time we start work and our conditions of work, that if you work hard, you'll get ahead, you should follow the rules, all sorts of things that are largely taken for granted. And to the extent that there seems to be some evidence to the contrary, then it's often treated as something of an aberration that should be addressed so that we can, things can return to the norm. Now, it's not my remit to debunk those particular assertions today, but what I want to suggest to you in the course of this meeting is that it's in the process of fighting for change that these assumptions come up for a radical degree of questioning, and it's in people trying to better their own conditions that actually they can be won to a totally different way of running society. Now, I think, though, we need to, first of all, address some more preliminary questions. The first being that change does happen. It's no good talking about how it might happen if people are sitting out there thinking, oh, nothing's ever going to change. So I'll address that first. And then the second thing I want to talk about quite at length is the source of ideas and ideology under capitalism, and then as well why people accept false explanations for the way the world works, what philosophers have called false consciousness, what Donald Trump calls fake news. Because I think the way that you address that question then informs your answer to this question up here. Because if you think that people just accept rubbish ideas because they're deluded, they're just stupid, they believe what they see on television, that kind of thing, well, then you're more likely to be drawn to some kind of elitist politics or even some kind of authoritarian politics that says there should be you should be for minority rule because the masses are hopeless. You might, if your answer is that people are bought off, then you'll put your efforts of organising into the most marginal and the poorest of the poor. Which might be a reasonable thing to do where there are particular struggles, but if it means that you're dismissive of where people take up struggles to better their own conditions, like workplace struggles, then I'd say there's a bit of a problem. Or more generously, if you think that it all comes down to people being poorly educated, then you'll advocate for a better education system. system. And there's, you know, there's some value, certainly some value in that, but it's also got some real limitations, which I'm not going to have a lot of time to deal with this afternoon, but I hope we'll come out in the discussion, because I at least want to outline what is the Marxist approach to these questions, and then in the discussion we can take up you know, some of the things about sort of what is put forward as alternatives to that. Right, so on the first, oh, here we go, we're past that. Right, this is my first time with slides, so we'll see how we go. They weren't working 5 minutes ago, so this is a great advance. Now, you may be wondering why I have a gentleman dressed as a lobster. Does anybody recognise this man?
Yeah.
Jordan Peterson. Yes, who said that?
Somewhere.
Somewhere, I think it was you, Jesse. And what is Jordan, what is his theory about lobsters? Can you tell us? Oh, there's a voice? If you want. Yeah. Also have serotonin. That to me seems like a fair summary of Jordan Peterson's theories about why hierarchies are naturalized. And I pop him on the slide. I raise him as an example of academic theories that reinforce the idea that there is something essential about human nature that is separate to the way that people are socialised under capitalism. I would say that the idea that of human beings living in hierarchies is a relatively recent invention of the way that humans have chosen to organise our societies. In fact, people lived for over 10,000 years in collective gathering-hunter societies. People have organised their societies in vastly different ways across human history. And yet there will always be a bloke who wants to say, because of the lobsters, people are meant to live in a hierarchical society. Another example, the bloke beside him looking decidedly more respectable and serious is Adam Smith, whose ideas about the development of the market are often portrayed as being about a essential entrepreneurial human spirit, which in fact is anathema to Adam Smith's history of the development of capitalism. But nonetheless, a sort of a popularisation of his ideas holds up that the way, again, the way that things are today, they have always been into the past. And I think as well, there is a degree to which we can fall into this. You know, we have a tendency, I think, to be in a mindset of snapshotting how things are for us now and projecting that into the future and projecting it back into the past. And I think that's because our own lives are, you know, are fairly limited in scope. You know, you have choice about where you work, you have choice about what you eat for dinner and all sorts of things. But fundamentally, I know for me, I can live my whole life within a radius of about 5 kilometres of my bed, and, you know, that's about the extent of it for weeks on end. And so, you know, it's not a vast sort of experience, you know, to take in. And so it's that kind of routinism of our lives that sometimes narrows our horizon that makes us more susceptible to accepting these explanations that the way things are today is how they always have been, and therefore always will be. And that's one of the most insidious things that capitalism convinces us of, that there is no alternative and there's something natural about the way things are today. And yet you think about it, 250 years ago, people thought that that guy, Louis XIV, had a special insight into the will of God. The most slavery was accepted as a legitimate form of work, and the local priest was held up as the most authoritative font of wisdom in a community. There aren't too many people today that go to their local religious figure if they want advice, or, you know, they want an answer to a scientific question or whatever it might be. That's why we have Google. you know, a little more than 50 years ago, people still thought that the expectation for women upon getting married was that she'd leave her job and have children, and that would be her primary responsibility before going back into the workforce. You couldn't show a kiss between an interracial couple on screen and get a run in an average cinema. Ideas about childhood and adolescence were totally different. And if you stretch back more further than that, actually, ideas that seem core to our individuality have been radically different across across the ages, whether it's our sexuality, our morality, practice of religion, who we worship, how often we worship, how we do that, all these sorts of things that we think sometimes are about our identity, actually are norms of behaviour that have been socially constructed and have and human beings have found vastly different ways of addressing those things. Over time. So what we need to do then is try to explain why some ideas gain currency at particular times and why at other times they fall out of favour. Because ultimately we want our ideas to become popular in the future. Now on this question, Marx sided with the materialist school of philosophy in his time. Those that thought that our beliefs were shaped by our material circumstances, either our individual living arrangements, but also how their people's society is organised. He famously declared that being determines consciousness. Is this on a slide? Oh, there we go. That statement, being determines consciousness, was a direct refutation to the idealist school of philosophers who thought that the key thread running throughout history was a progression of ideas. It's perhaps epitomised by Descartes' maxim, I think, therefore I am. For Marx, he identified that the first need people have to address is how to live. That means how they're going to eat, where they're going to find shelter. And that these things are satisfied through labour. And unlike animals, who also have to meet these needs, humans have the capacity to labour consciously. We have both a direct consciousness about what we're doing, but we also have capacity for abstraction. So we can explain to ourselves or to another person why we're doing what we're doing. We have the capacity for memory, so we can learn how, based on how things have been done previously. We can accumulate knowledge, and we can imagine how we might do things differently. Plus, we've evolved in such a way as to satisfy these needs through collective labour, and that allowed us to evolve the capacity for language, to communicate with each other. But the crux of this is that for Marx, thought was connected to labour, and that social organisation of production had a bearing on our ideas, the ideas that dominated in a society. In the first instance, the development of production sets parameters on what ideas can gain currency. Most of the jobs that we do today were unimaginable before the invention of electricity, let alone a few decades ago before the internet was something that was widely used. So it has limits then in terms of what we can imagine. But it also has an impact on values. So, for example, under feudalism, a society where very little changes over hundreds of years, where your social standing is determined by your birthright, the idea that that guy can get ahead by working hard is pretty marginal, because no matter how hard a peasant works on his field, obviously a degree of hard work is necessary. But fundamentally, what will determine whether it's a good year or a bad year is the weather patterns. If you can get ahead, it's going to likely be through some kind of trickery. Maybe you knock off the Lord, or, you know, through military prowess. So in a society where the Lord can expropriate an amount of the harvest from the people living on their land, a value like loyalty is highly prized. But an idea of ingenuity or entrepreneurialism seems pretty foreign at that point. So the ideas that dominate in any society are the ideas of the ruling class. The statement that Marx made in the Communist Manifesto. Under capitalism, where goods and services are commodified, indeed everything is commodified, follows that ideas are also a commodity to be bought and sold. Think of the way that academia is an industry, or consultants, or PR professionals, journalists. You know, there is whole industries that are built to propagate ideas of one sort or another. And so it follows that the capitalist class who own the means of producing goods and services will also be able to own the means of manufacturing and disseminating ideas. You know, they can buy the employees with particular skills. They can equip them, or they need to equip them with the right technology, with phones, with computers. They need to house them in an office. They need to pay the electricity bills, get the lights on. You know, in other words, that's why we have the likes of Rupert Murdoch that own TV stations, or, you know, the capitalists that own film studios or broadcasters or newspapers, even the cinemas where we see films, publishing houses, social media platforms, and so forth, are by and large owned by the ruling class. And so they're able to use these mediums to propagate ideas that that prop up their own class interests. Media ownership, we know, in this country is concentrated into the hands of a few. I've got some of the stars of the show up there. You might not recognise the bloke at the top, that's Kerry Stokes. He owns the Seven Network with his mate. We will recognise, I hope you recognise, Tony Abbott. They're very explicit about how they can use these platforms to promote their ideas. You know, the owner of 2GB is close personal friends with Alan Jones, its main shock jock, for example. Their influence over our perception of events, how governments are tracking, how they, cover protests, which, you know, is meaningful for us, is pretty obvious a lot of the time. Less overtly, though, also influence the way that we perceive things through presenting news as being separated between the social pages from the economic pages, politics, sport, all of those things as separate mediums rather than in some way, connected. They shape our views not just through what they portray in the news, but also what they don't portray, what doesn't rate and mention. But there's also cultural institutions. Now, my next slide, I need to put some caveat around. When I'm talking about, you know, cultural institutions, people think maybe, you know, things like the film production or theatres or museums, all these sorts of institutions are much more benign, surely. And yet I'd say that they shape the way our norms and our beliefs through giving us characters that we can relate to, giving us messages about who we should aspire to or character traits that we should hold up, and those that are targets of derision. They inadvertently give us explanations for human behaviour or human nature. They show many critical things, of course, but they also, in a way that provides only partial explanations for why things happen. And very rarely, too rarely, do we see resistance from it. And we all, I think, relish the counter-examples of that, and can think of counter-examples of that. But it is you know, partly they stand out for us because, you know, the norm is much more MasterChef or Married at First Sight or, you know, just the thing that springs to mind is, you know, cricket. Nothing wrong with cricket, but cricket's in the news at the moment, you know, all those sorts of things. Now, this slide is not, those people are not the directors of the Melbourne Theatre Company. One of them is the director of the Melbourne Theatre Company, that guy there. He's one of the Meyer family. That is a Meyer family portrait. I liked it because they look so incredibly pompous. I make the point about the board of directors of the Melbourne Theatre Company because you might expect that an institution like that would be populated with people with arts backgrounds. In fact, it's people like Mr. Meyer, who are major capitalists in this city. Alongside him are senior public servants, the Vice-Chancellor, the Chancellor of Melbourne Uni, people with backgrounds in banking and finance. You know, for these people, they view their board positions as hobbies, as a way sort of they tell us to give back to the community. And yet it actually means that it's another way that the capitalist class can exert some influence over what we see, as content. Now, obviously, they don't exert this through being a Borg and, you know, just feeding us with delusions. It's mediated by the fact that the people who produce these things are workers themselves. You know, journalists are workers. Writers are workers. Cameramen are workers. As well, they need to produce a product that is authentic, that, you know, we relate to in some way. So there has to be a kernel of truth at the heart of it in order for it to have some mass appeal. And as I said, there's plenty of subversive examples that we can point to, but they are dwarfed by the many, many examples of things that I think reinforce the way the system works. And I've got, you know, a picture of Blue Heelers to represent really the proliferation of cop shows that are there to show us that our local cops are just there to track down the bad guys as opposed to hit you over the head with a baton, although they don't do that anymore in Victoria. Apparently they have much more dangerous weapons to attack us with now, thanks to the Andrews government. Okay. And the last... The last institution, ideological institution, is the school system. You know, those guys, rebels from the Breakfast Club. I think, you know, the school system shapes our ideas not just through what is taught, but even more fundamentally in shaping the behaviours of young people, that you must submit to an authority figure, that you will be disciplined if you step out of line, that you've got to be on time, that you've got to meet deadlines, that you've got to learn to cooperate to an extent with your classmates, but you're also going to be marked in competition with them. It sort of instills the values that prepares people for a life of submission under capitalism. Why are we here? That's not right.
Out of order.
Oh, out of order. Oh, dear. Oh, well. Oh, no, I know where we are. Okay, all right, I'm back. The ideological institutions under capitalism are vital to maintaining the status quo. As Trotsky said, a system that is based on a minority expropriating the wealth of a majority that is created by the majority would not last a week if it was based on force alone. But the mechanisms of to convince people to accept their lot are not just ideological, they're also structural. The way that goods and services are produced for the market actually obscures that their value has been created by workers. The market seems to have its own laws. It goes up and down, seemingly by its own volition. The value of shares do not seem to have any bearing to the workers, to anything to do with the workers who have who've created the goods for sale. And yet, conversely, the market will have a significant impact on workers' ability to do all sorts of things. What food they buy, can afford, where they travel, whether they have a job, and in what area they have a job. This gives people a sense that the market is anarchic and beyond control. Not even government seem to be able to control how it behaves. That powerlessness is reinforced for people at a workplace level, where decisions about their shifts, their pay, their conditions are all made by boards of directors rather than people on the shop floor. But structurally, the system is also based on a contradiction, and that is that in competition for profits, the capitalists are driven to relentlessly attack the conditions of the working class, and these attacks are what drives resistance. People may accept all sorts of things, and we wish there was more resistance, but sooner or later, people do draw a line, and it's at these moments that their power becomes apparent. That's when we can move to these guys. These are a picture of the West Virginian teachers' strike that you will have heard about, bits and pieces about from people in the conference, and you might have followed when it was happening recently. The strike, as a weapon of the working class, is the most effective way of taking action. But it also reveals the power of workers at the heart of the system. It pierces through what is so often hidden, that all of the wealth in society is created by workers, that workers make everything in our society function. That becomes clear when people stop work and they shut down their workplace and they stop the flow of profits to their bosses. Not only do they feel their own power, but they see the vulnerability of their bosses. They see their dependence on their work. At a recent strike in Melbourne on the waterfront, at the port that's run by Cube, which is Chris Corrigan, formerly of Patrick's Corporation, his new enterprise, the 48-hour stoppage of dock workers over their long-running enterprise bargaining dispute. They watched as Cube flew in 36 managers by helicopter to unload a ship, except they unloaded the wrong one. So, you know, people also see their incompetence as well. When the New South Wales train drivers just before Christmas put overtime bans on driving trains, it brought the system almost to a standstill. It couldn't cope. And yet the directors of New South Wales trains couldn't just get behind the wheel themselves. They were hysterical. That's why they made the application they did to the Fair Work Commission and disgracefully got their way. When people see that reversal of power, people gain confidence, and it opens them up to new horizons. The sort of petty, trivial things that we worry about in our day-to-day lives gets pushed to the background for once. And people think that all sorts of things suddenly become possible because they're doing something that maybe 6 months ago they never envisioned that they'd be doing. Plus, every picket line that goes on for any length of time raises the question of all sorts of organisational things. How are we going to get food? How are we going to get support? We've got to do outreach. How are we going to deal with, you know, the police? You know, what are we going to say about a court application that our bosses are making? Those sorts of things have to be determined democratically, because the whole basis of working class action, a strike, has to be organised on the basis of agreement from a majority, and that the rest will go along with the decision of the majority. And that gets replicated in the way the strike is actually organised. And one of the things that was so wonderful about the West Virginian teachers' strike was the rank and file participation, that the union leadership was tied up in the negotiations, but the rank and file were prepared to act independently of the leadership. And that's so important for building up people's sense of confidence in their own ability. And for socialists, it's quite a different approach that we take to that compared to the union leaders, who often grant workers a much more passive role in the running of a strike. But it also, these are times when solidarity is meaningful for people. To give you, you know, it poses the question, when the battle lines are drawn, which side are you on? As this participant in the West Virginian teacher strike describes that kind of phenomenon, he says, "I walked out from my house. I looked to the right, working lady, raising kids by herself. I looked to my left, small business owner. Across the street, retired small business owner. Next door to him, another working person, blue collar all around. So as soon as you see something happen to one person, you're like, wait, that's me too. Everybody jumps on together. That's how this got taking off so fast. We're all working class. Thank you." It's that basis of solidarity where people identify with the struggles of others. People can be one to breaking down prejudices as well. Suddenly the divisions that are shoved down people's throat matter less when you're standing shoulder to shoulder with people on a picket line. And I just want to take a moment before I move on for people to have a look at some of the placards while I've been speaking, because I think it speaks to the way that, you know, a whole lot of ideas are up for grabs and are questioned when people are actually fighting for their rights. You know, there's one about the court. If we go back to, here we go. This one I love, in the middle, the power of people is stronger than the people in power. And a lovely placard about a teacher saying this is the best lesson for my students in standing up for themselves. And indeed, you know, one of the things that gets said again and again in interviews with the West Virginian teachers strike since they've gone back to school is how much things have changed, that they were able to turn over their lessons to their kids' questions, and they saw how their students had been following their actions on Facebook, and, you know, described how it's a completely different atmosphere. And I think that gives us a sense of how rapidly people transform in their outlook. Now, in a revolutionary situation, this is writ large. Revolutions are also caused by the crises in the system, either by war or by economic crisis. I'm going to talk about the Egyptian Revolution, which people probably today only identify as being with the counter-revolution. But in 2011, masses of Egyptians were strong enough to overthrow the Mubarak regime through taking to the central square in Cairo in their millions. And they removed a dictator who'd been in power, I've forgotten now, 29 years? 25 years? Having been too scared to take any action of that, of anything like that magnitude before. And as they did so, they had to experiment with how to organise their struggle in a democratic way. Those same features of a picket line, of, you know, addressing the key concerns of the day in your struggle. In a revolutionary situation, workers have to find ways of organising themselves democratically to address those questions. One of the participants in the struggles in Tahrir Square described that kind of atmosphere. He said, "You go down to Tahrir, you sit on a corner, and within a few minutes, you'll be in the middle of separate political discussions. The energy of people's ideas is inspiring." We also saw the way that in a society fundamentally where sectarian divisions between Christians and Muslims are rife, on the barricades, these things became immaterial. One of the pictures there is of Christians standing around Muslims to protect them at prayer time. For women as well, it was often the first time that they felt confident enough to go into the centre of the city at night and know that they would not have to submit to harassment. You know, the picture of a man and a woman in an argument. You know, there's a woman in the burqa with her, we think, you know, family member, you know, a young child holding up the placard. And interviews with women activists, you know, described how they didn't have to worry about what they looked like, you know, before they left the house, because there were more important things, you know, the life and death questions that they were grappling with. And that down in the square, they were able to sleep overnight, you know, to even participate in the fighting of the barricades. It's those sorts of things that rapidly break down people's prejudice. However, it's not a foregone conclusion that people will adopt the right conclusions out, you know, or the right lessons out of every question that comes up. People go into these battles with all of the our socialization and the, you know, the rubbish that we have been fed. People also have their own experience to draw upon as well. So it leads to people having contradictory, you know, unthought out ideas. And that's why political intervention can be so important, that there is always a minority under capitalism that do think it's possible to change things and seriously come to grips with how that might be done. Learn the lessons from history. And that's our project in Socialist Alternative. We're not waiting for the next picket line or the next revolution before we develop our ideas and our theory. There is a rich source from previous struggles to draw upon. But the point of the talk is that these theories haven't been developed in a passive setting or through individual study. These ideas, to have any force, have to be connected to the struggle itself. So in conclusion, the conditions of capitalism breed both passivity but also resistance. And it's in the struggling to change our social conditions that people manage to change themselves. Socialist politics is based on a vision of the transformation of the mass of people. And we hold fast to that even in non-revolutionary times. And I spoke a lot about the Egyptian Revolution, and so I want to finish with a quote from one of its participants, a poet, Mahmoud Barghouti, that I think really speaks to holding on to that vision in the worst of times. Quite a long quote, but I'll finish after this. "I did not expect the trajectory of the revolution to reach these lows and to take us back full circle to the triumphant and vengeful counter-revolution. Today, many see hope and optimism as obscene words, but there are two reasons to feel encouraged. One is that the physical causes of the revolution of the 25th of January, corruption, tyranny and poverty, they still exist and they have an uglier face. The second is that for millions of Egyptians who experienced the glorious moments and passed through its pain and its joys, the discovery of their potential, their self-esteem and their courage will not be easily lost. The fact that they did it once is proof that they can do it again." And that's what I think we have to hold on to.